My name is Walter Bowman, and the title of this session is The Church Growth Movement and the Gospel. I always hate to, I used to hate, to say my name at the beginning of something till I heard the story of the Columbia University professor who remembered the names of all of his former students and what courses they took with him and even where they sat in class. And he was in a Houston airport, saw a former student in a ticket line and rushed up to her and said, "You took a course in the history of English literature at Columbia University in the summer of 1985. "That's right," she said, "and your name is Janet Larson." "Oh my goodness," she said, "and you sat right next to John Smith." "Yes," she said, "but who are you?" So for former friends and former students, I'm Walt Bowman, all right? Let's, we've got to get that straight. The word, this is a series, the rest of this week, on evangelism and on the growth of the church. But it's also going to be about some basic theology. I want to talk about worship and the Lord's Supper tomorrow, and about baptism and evangelism on Thursday, and about evangelizing children, which is one of the most important things that we need to be doing, on Friday. And then I want to talk about the Lord's Prayer as the mission prayer of the Christian community on Saturday. So we have a lot of theological stuff that we're going to be talking about under the general rubric of church growth. The word evangelism, or the concept of evangelism, really originated in the United States and got exported to Asia and to Africa. When one spends any amount of time in Europe, or at least when one used to spend time in Europe, one rarely heard the term evangelism at all. And the reason, of course, is obvious. Everybody in Europe basically got baptized, or at least everybody who wanted to. In Germany, you have to take formal steps to get out of the church. And of course, people are doing that. It's called austragen. Man tragt sich aus die Kirche. You identify yourself as somebody who wants to get out of the church. In Sweden, in fact, they discovered to their chagrin that hundreds, literally hundreds of thousands of people, up to 10% of the population, had never been baptized and still thought of themselves as members of the Church of Sweden. In England, the established church there annually baptizes about 60 to 75% of the people who are born in England. So evangelism was not a concept at all. It has become a concept in Europe now, as church leaders are talking about re-evangelizing Europe. And it's become a kind of urgent agenda item for a lot of the churches in Europe because of the widespread decline in participation in the life of the Christian church. But it came from America. I think that's one of the things that needs to be said. And it has to do, I think, with three things that are characteristic of the United States. The first of these is the need to bring people into the churches. One of the things that happened as Europeans came to this country is that they did not bring their churches with them. We have the myth in our heads, I think, of the pilgrims as God-fearing and religious people who came to this country to find religious freedom, but they were a tiny minority of the people who came to this country. Most of the emigrants who came here came for economic reasons. They came because it was tough in Europe because they were disinherited, second sons, third sons, or because they belonged to the underclass, or for a variety of reasons, but they certainly did not come for religion. The Church of England followed its citizens under the rule of the Bishop of London, who was in charge of all the American colonies until after the Revolutionary War. But the first census of 1790 revealed that about 6 to 10% of the 4 million people who lived in the United States actually belonged to churches. 6 to 10%. The notion that many of us have, you see, that religion was a kind of pervasive factor in American life, simply isn't true. In 1830, some 40 years after the first census, about 13% of the people in the United States belonged to churches or religious institutions. And in 1860, on the eve of the Civil War, with a population of something like 30 million people in the United States, about 6 million belonged to churches. That's around 20%. All right? So the vision that we have of Americans all belonging to churches is a mistaken notion. As late as 1940, the eve of the Second World War, less than half of the people of this country belonged to churches or synagogues. It was about 49%. See? I mean, I think we need to understand that. The huge boom that took place in American religion came after the Second World War. From 1945 to 1960, American church membership more than doubled, and in percentage terms, it went from 49% to 69%. That's a bulge. It's just a huge bulge in sort of church membership. However, a lot of denominations came to identify that almost as normal, you see, as if 70% of the population ought to belong to the church, and something is wrong if it doesn't happen. So we have gotten considerably worried in the last decade or so because there has been a kind of percentage decline, although numerically churches continue to grow, many of them at least. The biggest hit, if one wants to put it that way, in terms of membership decline, has occurred with regard to the so-called mainline churches, the traditional Protestant denominations, Presbyterians, Episcopalians, Methodists, United Church of Christ, Lutherans, all have various percentages of membership decline. I think the largest decline has been Presbyterians and Episcopalians. But the mainline churches have experienced a decline. I think that the reasons for it are not far to seek. And they parallel the reasons for the expansion. In the 1950s and 60s, America felt very good about itself. We had just finished the most popular war in American history, the Second World War, which enjoyed huge and majority support on the part of the people. We had, in a sense, saved the world from a terrible evil. I mean, I'm not making this up. This was Nazism. This was the Holocaust. This was all the terrible things that the Nazis did. We saw ourselves as the dominant power in the world and a power for good. We felt good about ourselves, and President Eisenhower had called the war a crusade, a religious term. Americans began to join churches in large numbers, partly because it was another way of being a good American. In the same way that you go join the PTA, supported Boy Scouts, you join churches. And Eisenhower put it as well as anyone when he says, America is built on a firmly felt religious faith and I don't care what it is. So it really didn't matter what faith. I mean, you plant a church, it was bound to grow because Americans were interested in being religious, not necessarily in being particularly Christian, much less a particular denomination. Getting into a church was as easy as joining the PTA. 4 weeks of Sunday morning classes on Presbyterian polity or Lutheran doctrine or Anglican, how to find your way around the Book of Common Prayer, and you were in the church. Baptisms happened almost as a matter of course or didn't even happen at all. We still get people at seminary today who have been members of churches for 20 years but weren't ever baptized. And so now the ELCA, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, is insisting on its candidacy forms for pastors that they be able to identify and demonstrate that they have in fact been baptized. What this does is it goes back to the 60s and the early 70s when people were just swept into churches with little teaching and often not even baptism. Now, what happened to all of that? It's easy to say what happened to all of that. Civil conflict. The two big things from the 60s and the 70s were the civil rights movement and the Vietnam War. And both of them deeply divided the society and deeply divided the churches. Robert Wuthnow, a sociologist of religion at Princeton University, says this is the fundamental new phenomenon in American religion. You see, that we now find more collegiality, not with people in our denomination, but with people who are with us on a particular issue. See, were you for or against the Vietnam War? Were you for or against civil rights? Were you for or against abortion, which is now one of the big dividing things? And this links people across denominational lines, and in a sense, the liberal side of this has frequently been the loser. So the Protestant churches that, at least officially, opposed the Vietnam War were the ones who lost members. And the Protestant churches that supported American military policy, its anti-communism and so on, were the ones who gained. It was no secret that after the Gulf War, huge Baptist churches, the fastest growing churches in America, had yellow ribbon Sundays, you know, or one of them in Memphis made General Schwarzkopf an honorary deacon, although he's not a Baptist, and proclaimed on its church bulletin board, I'm quoting directly, "America is a man again." Gee. And big displays of soldiers in camouflage uniforms marching down church aisles, unfurling 60-foot flags from the ceilings of sanctuaries and so on. So the church decline and church growth have something to do, at least, with the kind of divisive issues that have confronted American political life as well. Now, so the first reason why evangelism has become a big term in America is because of the need to get people into the churches. The churches would die in this country if they didn't attract and recruit members. In Europe, of course, you can have a congregation of 50, but everybody pays taxes and the church is able to maintain itself, be a wealthy institution, and do a lot of good things, even though it doesn't have a lot of people in church on Sunday morning. In America, that simply can't happen. The second thing that makes evangelism uniquely American is free competition between churches that are now all disestablished. See, there is very, very little competition to the Lutheran and the Catholic churches in Germany. When I was over there in 1983 for the Luther anniversary and was giving some lectures in Darmstadt, I commented to the group of church leaders that I had there that there were about 8 million Lutherans in the United States and something like 35 million Baptists. This was a shocker for them. There are perhaps 15 to 20,000 Baptists in Germany. That isn't hardly a congregation in Atlanta. And 26 to 28 million Lutherans. I was present in 1985 at the first formal dialogue between European Baptists and European Lutherans in 1985. And the Baptists are a tiny minority, you see, because the Lutheran Church is in many ways the established church in large parts of Germany, and of course all over in Scandinavia. Once in this country, the church became disestablished. No churches enjoying the patronage of the government or of establishment, free competition, then evangelism became the way that the churches competed with each other for membership. The USA, in that sense, is post-Christendom. Christendom means everybody's a Christian. That's Europe. We are post-Christendom. People don't start out being Christians. They need to be brought in. And third, the third factor that makes evangelism, I think, an important concept in the United States is what I call the frontier or revival character of American religion. Harold Bloom, in a brilliant book called The American Religion, starts out by describing the Cane Ridge Revival of 1801. In August of 1801, a Presbyterian pastor by the name of Barton Stone held a revival in Cane Ridge, Kentucky, to which 15 to 20,000 people came. This is 1801. You have to understand, that's a lot of people. They came from all over. And it was, of course, a strange event. Lots of preaching, lots of socializing, lots of religious phenomena that still defy historical description. Somewhere I've got Sidney Ahlstrom describing this. I just have to read a little bit about what it was like. But Ahlstrom, why can't I find this? Oh, yes. Ahlstrom says this: Stone described the bodily manifestations as beginning with the jerks. These are people who are now grasped by the preaching, then proceeding to falling, dancing, barking, laughing, running, singing. Stone admitted that there were many eccentricities and much fanaticism in this excitement, he says, but he insisted good effects were seen and acknowledged in every neighborhood. This was the beginning of the American revival tradition, and I'm going to talk more particularly about that on Thursday. I'm going to talk about American revivalism, and but that's the character of frontier religion for a variety of reasons. Now, the latest strategy in American evangelism is a movement known as church growth. And the latest phenomenon is the so-called mega church. And a couple of months ago, Peter Jennings on ABC did a program called In the Name of God, in which he looked at three mega church types. One was the so-called laughing church, where they just bring in people who can laugh well and get everybody laughing till they're rolling in the aisles. Packs them in. We're not going to look at that. Well, it's not really much of a temptation. I mean, it's funny, but I don't think it's really going to catch on. The second type that he looked at is a group called the Vineyard, and we're not going to see that one either. But it's an interesting phenomenon. The one we're going to look at is the segment on Willow Creek Church. This is a suburb of Chicago, and it's the first part of the Jennings program, and it's, I think, quite instructive. Let's see if we can get it going here now.
What it is today is its senior pastor, 43-year-old Bill Hybels. It didn't feel to me at all religious to be in the, auditorium, sanctuary? It's really more like the theater. Is that intentional?
Yes. It is, because one of the things that we're really about as a church is to try to help non-church people feel that they can investigate Christianity in sort of a neutral setting.
You didn't think it was important even to have one cross?
We're very serious about what Christ did on the cross. But to capture the essence of Christianity in a single symbol is a little dangerous, we feel.
So, what's going on?
Mom kicked me out.
Why did she kick you out?
Because she walked in on me and Krista in my bedroom, in my bed.
Who is Krista?
Yes.
With non-believers in mind, Bill Hybels has radically redesigned how to do church. Purely secular dramas are a regular part of the service. This one, which deals with premarital sex and adultery, features actors playing father and son.
Okay, so now is this where you give me a little talk about safe sex? Or did you just want to borrow a condom?
Hey, go ahead! Go ahead! Come on, go ahead!
20 years ago, Bill Hybels launched Willow Creek by finding out just what people did not want from a church. It still rankles his critics that he started the church by taking a poll.
When we were going to start Willow Creek, I didn't know this community at all. So I and three others went door to door for a month, and we just asked people, do you actively attend a local church? If they said yes, we said, good for you, keep going. If they said, no, we don't attend a local church, then we just asked the simple question, would you tell us why you stopped going?
What Bill Hybels learned is that people didn't like old-fashioned sermons and they were bored by traditional church music. Which is why Willow Creek today is specifically user-friendly. It has state-of-the-art daycare and a multitude of Sunday school programs. There's also a food court and a bookstore.
Push your shoulder blades together.
And what they call Christian aerobics.
You're an animal like a rock. Right? Keep going.
For your biology degree, got you, what are you, selling insurance? Hey, listen, young man.
Making it all work is a paid staff of professional musicians, producers, directors, and technicians. They begin every week with a critique of the previous Sunday service.
I still felt the pacing thing could be a little tighter on it.
The one part that seems really long to me is after the bag.
Yeah.
The church has a full-time staff of 167 people and an annual budget of $13 million.
One, two, and
effort to prepare for every week's service is enormous. All of the singers and actors are members of the congregation who volunteer their talents. Lead singer Craig Ferguson, who makes his living singing commercial jingles, wrote this song.
Exponential growth with small groups. I mean, if it continues in this pace, how do we get them all in the house?
To run a church that operates 7 days a week, from small group Bible study to the big weekend services, Willow Creek has adopted a highly corporate model of organization. Although his salary is just $67,000 a year, Hybels could be described as the CEO.
I could eliminate it.
When he was in his 20s, Hybels was set to inherit his father's produce business. Instead, he started a Christian musical group. Over time, the group evolved to become Willow Creek.
I don't think we can achieve that objective and break it up with the NCR.
Today, Bill Hybels is much in demand all over the country. Among other things, he's a spiritual advisor to President Clinton, who consults him on a fairly regular basis.
Historians of American Christianity point out that religion in America has always been entrepreneurial, and that you're the latest example of the entrepreneurial pastor. How does that sit with you?
Well, I get uncomfortable when people mix too much of spirituality and business, because fundamentally we're not selling a product. We're really not. Fundamentally, we're proclaiming the message of amazing grace.
Oh, friends, do you know what is at stake this very moment? There's some of you that are thinking about it right now. You're saying, salvation is a gift, forgiveness through what Christ did on the cross. You're saying, it's too good to be true.
Among the people who come to Willow Creek, some find what they want and stay.
Boy, you look great, Kenzie.
Others find what Jeff Ross, an insurance broker, describes as Christianity light.
Can you make that sound?
We were amazed.
Good.
Because the first time we went there, there was a long, long traffic jam. And there were police, and it was kind of like going to a Bears game or a large concert or something. And then when we got inside, we were instructed that we needed to sit way up high on a balcony because we had children in the childcare area, and so we had to watch it on a video screen up in front of us. And then periodically through the service, there would be like a caption along the bottom of the video screen that would say, with the parents of children number 58694 or whatever, please come to the nursery and take care of your kids. We just kind of looked at each other and said, you know, this is really just not church for us. It seemed very different to us. It wasn't typical of our experience with how we like to practice our religion. It obviously works for many, many people. And the key to good marketing is to give people what it is they want.
It doesn't bother me at all that they use marketing techniques to get me to go. It gets me there, and I hear the message then, and I appreciate that they're making it easy for me. I like things that are easy.
John DeLapp, a mechanic, has been attending Willow Creek for about a year.
It's like going to a movie, only better. I wish it was a little longer. 2 hours, 2.5 hours would be nice. They have songs that I like. They have dramas with real actors. And it is slick. And it makes me want to come back and hear more. The more I hear, then, the more I learn. And the better Christian that I'll be.
whatever people think of his approach, Bill Hybels is attracting people to church who might otherwise have stayed away. Bill Hybels says that is all he's trying to accomplish.
Your heart needs a place to call home.
A few days ago, I was with a man who was in spiritual process, and he said, "So explain to me again, what does it mean to be a Christian?" Now, I have a choice to make at that moment. He's asking the central question of the universe. Am I going to use words and ideas that make me sound smart, or am I going to communicate the core of the Christian message in a way that he can understand? And when you have enough relationships with people whose eternity is hanging in the balance, and when you know they have families and children who are looking up to them for spiritual direction, you just want to make it clear.
See a new paradigm for doing church.
And here is something else that is very clear. Willow Creek has started something big, and hundreds of churches all over the country want to be part of it.
Unpack that a little bit for me, Jim. What are you saying there? What? So what?
This is a staff meeting of the Willow Creek Association, a network of more than 800 churches who look to Willow Creek as a model for how to do church in the 1990s.
We get to see a church that is stretching on both ends of the spiritual spectrum.
Okay, so...
And some of them are really stretching. Churches inspired by Willow Creek make the mother church look tame. This is actually the Sunday morning service at Daybreak Church in rural western Michigan.
I can't think. I can't make any sound at all. Most people think that I'm sick or having a seizure.
This is an example of a church going to great lengths to attract and involve people in the 1990s. Pastor Wes Dukin.
It's not all church, it's not all gloom and doom, and all of you take your Bible now, and let's open the hymnal, and let's just bore each other. Let's show them we can also have fun. And that can be very controversial.
What is controversial in this community is Daybreak's annual Super Bowl party. This year, it made the local news.
People showed up for the super service in Jenison. Reverend Wesley Dupin says the football extravaganza is a great way to encourage fellowship.
I think Jesus Christ, number one, would be at an event like this. I think he'd be in Miami tonight, and he would be right there enjoying it. He enjoyed parties.
On this Sunday, Daybreak turned to David Letterman for inspiration.
During a boring sermon. Drum roll, please.
I think Jesus Christ would use similar methods if he were here today.
Number 10, learn a second language. Number 9, pick a scab.
With all the technology that is available, I think he would do the same thing. He would use all the link-ups, he would use video, he would use sports, he would use everything that basically we're using right now. To do what? To attract the person who's looking for hope.
And here it is, folks, the number one thing you would do during a boring sermon, go ahead, kids, mine for those nose noogies.
I think you have to do some Madison Avenue, and I don't think that's a bad word. McDonald's has done it for years, they're smart.
The church as McDonald's. Certainly churches in the image of Willow Creek are springing up everywhere. Not far from Daybreak, Ridge Point, which meets in a local movie theater. Its pastor, Dave Garron.
The forms that are traditionally associated with the church are so incongruent with the world that we live in. I mean, you step through a time warp. in terms of the forms that you see.
Why don't you stand up with us right now? We're going to sing a song, maybe you know.
The danger is always that we will so accommodate ourselves to the culture in which we find ourselves that the message will be watered down. We'll give in to modernity. The key to avoiding that is to determine ahead of time what are the non-negotiables. I mean, what are the hills that you'll die on? Let's determine those up front, and let's do everything we can to protect and preserve those. As far as the rest, that's all negotiable.
Set out to do this program, our original intent was to analyze whether these new forms of worship were making religion more relevant, or were they diluting the message just to get people in the door. We found it hard to analyze people's spirituality. There are certainly those with fear that Christianity in America is in danger of losing its way. But however controversial, the church's effort to reinvent its forms and repackage its message is not at all new. The church has always tried new ways to attract people. Even the organ was once considered too worldly. Finally, the challenge is this. As these churches try to attract sellout crowds, are they in danger of selling out the gospel? Thank you for joining us. I'm Peter Jennings. Good night.
That was a marvelous program. I don't know how many of you saw the whole program when it appeared on television, but I think Jennings is a sensitive reporter and has left us, in a sense, with the crucial question, which I'm just going to throw out to you for a few minutes. What is happening in these mega churches and in commercial religion? Is the church like McDonald's? Ought it to be? Is that the way it works? Jennings raises the question, what is the church's gospel? And I'd like to hear from you as you respond to all of this for a few moments. Who's ready to start us off? Ellie, go ahead.
The thing that worries me is that it becomes, and I don't know the term, I know there's a term for this, but it's a church of feeling good.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't really confront the real issues that of our sinfulness and our need for saving. It's kind of like a feel-good church.
Uh-huh. Anybody else? Yes.
Well, you used the term at one point, said we want to give people a sense of hope, which I thought was very interesting. And clearly the idea is that for this large body of people in the United States, they do not feel there is any hope. So they're playing on that particular part of it.
Okay. First up there and then over here.
Our pastor, reviewed Little Creek 6 months or so ago, and one of the things that stuck in my mind is it's sort of like they removed all barriers to entry. The service was sort of non, there's nothing to be threatening there. And I think he actually stated that it's an open door, complete open door. And I think that appealed to me, because I think that a lot of churches have put a lot of different structure and requirements on entry into their church, whether implicit or explicit, or symbolic or non-symbolic. I thought that was one of the things I liked about Little Creek. They've gone out of their way to remove barriers of acceptance or et cetera.
Good. Yes.
My question through all of this was, what about discipleship? I didn't hear anything about discipleship. It was just getting people in the door, selling them something, and then what do you do with it once you've bought it? And that there wasn't any cost to the people who become a Christian. In other words, cheap grace.
Let's just dig in there at that point for a moment. Were there clues in... I thought Jennings' interview with Heibels was just very good and very instructive. Were there clues there as to what, in fact, Heibels is selling? I don't want to use the word because he doesn't like to use the word, but I think, in fact, that's what's going on. What is his gospel? What is he selling?
He's selling what people want.
Which is what?
And which was probably numbers, which is low commitment, which is ritual that they know already from the secular world.
Convenience, all of
convenience.
Yeah. He said amazing grace.
What?
He said amazing grace.
Mm-hmm. Saving grace.
Saving grace.
Saving grace. Oh, I didn't hear it right. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Oh,
I didn't. Well, I think he maybe said both. Let me just do something at this point. I think some of those things are all there. They're part of the packaging. But let's take him seriously. Let's take him as seriously as he takes himself. A couple of things I wrote down. He talks about eternity hanging in the balance. Remember that? I mean, he was quite emotional at that point. That he's got somebody where eternity is hanging in the balance. What is he talking about there? Yes.
He's talking about going to church so you go to heaven when you
die. Ah. So he really thinks that what he's doing is saying something to people which they need to hear, or they won't go to heaven when they die, they will instead go to hell when they die, right? I mean, at bottom, that's what Heibels is about. He thinks that the Christian gospel is, let's test this out now, some version of Jesus died for you. If you believe that, you'll go to heaven when you die. If you don't believe that, you'll go to hell when you die.
But you must make the decision.
But you have to make the decision. And his job is to get as many people to make a positive decision as humanly possible in this life before they die, because once they've died, it's all over. The decisions are made, it's either heaven or hell.
I saw something different.
Okay.
Before he sort of turned emotional, I thought he was magnificent. He was balancing two thoughts. One thought was being sort of the intellectual deliverer and interpreter of spiritual awareness. On the other hand, he had a what I call a contrapositive argument, and he was saying, should I let the person develop their own spiritual journey? He used a term I hadn't heard.
Spiritual transition.
Well, they were in spiritual transition. And I thought he was very wise in sort of balancing himself between those two polarities. Now, I hadn't looked at that. And then he jumped to sort of the bottom line which you interpreted in salvation. But I thought it was really interesting how delicately he was handling a person who was in spiritual transition, I think is the word I heard.
Mm-hmm.
And whether you allow that person to discover that, and that's a lifelong journey, or whether you approach it from more of an academic point of view and predefine it.
But either way, isn't it just an intensely personal experience that I have between me and God?
Mm-hmm.
Or am I just not hearing the community and the responsibility of the neighbor?
Hold that question for a moment and the comment, because I think Heibels is the best at whatever it is that he's doing. He's the best. He's smooth. He's insightful. He's intelligent. He's he communicates very well. I mean, there are all kinds of things that Hybels does well, but the key question is, what is it that he's doing? And I want to link that for a moment with the church growth movement, of which Hybels is, in many ways, the best example. It began with Donald McGavran, a returning missionary, who in 1970 published a book called Understanding Church Growth, 25 years ago. That book has been slightly revised, but it's been reprinted many times and sold in huge numbers by people like Wynne Arn and C. Peter Wagner. And what he tried to do, as a returning missionary, he tried to say, what is it that will enable the church to grow? But McGavran's basic and fundamental idea was some version of what I tried to say earlier, namely that the Christian gospel is a quite definite set of statements which, if you believe them, if you accept them as true, you will get to heaven. In 1973, D. James Kennedy, who's also on television, has a church in Coral Gables, Florida, published a book called Evangelism Explosion that became a widely used evangelism technique in this country. And he starts with the fundamental question, if you should die tonight, see, that's, I want to get back to discipleship in a moment, because it isn't really a discipling question. It's a question of, if you should die tonight, what are you going to say to God when he asks you, why should I let you into my heaven? See, and what Kennedy expected is that everybody's going to say, well, I've been a pretty good person. Kennedy says, wrong answer. Won't get you past the pearly gates. Let me tell you what the right answer is, right? And now the right answer is, I believe in Jesus who died for my sins. Now, if that's the right answer, and then the whole goal of the conversation that Kennedy wants you to have, and you can do it in 8 minutes, Heibel says five, but you can do it in 8 minutes, according to Kennedy, the goal of the conversation is get you to say, yes, I'll accept that as the answer that I must give to God when I get to heaven, when I die. That's what will let me into God's heaven. This was McGavran's fundamental goal. How many people can we get to say that kind of thing so that God will let them into heaven? So Gavran says in his basic principles that first of all, you have to go where people are. It doesn't help for a church to be located somewhere. If the people move away, or if the people move on, or if the people are in different places, go where the people are. Find out what will attract people. Find out what they want from church. This is exactly what Hybels did, surveying. But I want you to notice, when they showed pictures of the neighborhood, did anybody see three-car garages? Nice homes, so on and so on. Because why is this? That's where the people are. Where do you start mega churches? You don't start them in the inner city, although there are, of course, people there too. You start them in the suburbs, which is classic 1950s church growth strategy. You advertise. You need informality. Pat Kiefert, in his Welcoming the Stranger, says Americans are fundamentally ritually incompetent. Ritually incompetent. I mean, we really don't have good competence in public rituals. Quite a contrast. I was in England in April, attending a meeting, and spent some time in Cambridge with a former student, and went to Ely Cathedral on Sunday morning. large building full of people, by the way. I mean, it was really well filled with people, long lines for communion. But here I saw English school kids, lots of them, because there was a cathedral school there, and adults and church people, all of whom were quite ritually competent. The British excel at this in many ways. They know how to do processions. They know how to dress everybody up in something, one vestment or another, chains hanging around, mayors showing up with beadles in front of them, carrying maces, and oh my, it's just gorgeous. I don't know what an inauguration of a mayor looks like in your town, but it's probably quite informal. We're really somewhat intimidated, Kiefert says, by rituals. So McGavran's principle was as informal as possible. You treat the people who come not as a community, but as an audience. One of the things the people said up there, remember, is that it didn't feel like church to them. You got a number on the screen saying child number 115, parents go to room 178. I go to the symphony a lot in Columbus. We have seats in row G, have had them there for years. I don't even know, I mean, I recognize the people who sit next to me, but that's about all. It's because they've had those seats for about 20 years too. I don't think we've ever talked. We really don't have much interaction with anybody. We go for the concert, we go home. That's what you do here. You are an audience, not a community. And the setting is a theater. Not a community setting. We need to tell personal stories of what God means to me or what God has done for me. And above all, said McGavran, we need homogeneity. You want to be with the same kind of people, your kind of people, people who look like you, dress like you, talk like you, think like you, vote like you, more or less. But that's the way an organization, a religious organization, will be able to grow and to get its simple, fundamental message across. Because the whole thing is designed to have you have the right answer for God when you die. That's what it's designed to do. You don't need anything else. You can do that over television. Except that it's harder to raise the money over television. Jerry Falwell uses 16 minutes out of every half hour, more than half the time, just raising the money he needs to put his program on. Now he's got 14 minutes left to tell you, you need to say, I believe in Jesus when you die, otherwise you aren't going to get into heaven. That's what's in the balance. That's what's hanging in the balance. Now, what I wanted to do today is just to ask the question, what in fact is the church's gospel? I want to call attention to a couple of books in the bookstore. The best book I've found on evangelism is one by Walter Brueggemann. I think he's teaching at a Presbyterian seminary, but he probably belongs to the Evangelical and Reformed Church. It's called Biblical Perspectives on Evangelism. I'm going to be referring to this book all week long. It has four chapters, and the first one is, what is the church's gospel? What is the Christian gospel? Might be a better question. The other one is a book that I wrote called What Shall I Say? Discerning God's Call to Ministry. The first, it's actually about helping people make vocational decisions and not just vocation for pastoral ministry. But the first chapter is the Christian gospel. It's a chapter in which I tried to lay out as clearly as I can what I think the Christian gospel is. But it's helpful to look at the Greek words. There are 125 uses in the New Testament of the word gospel or gospelize, the verb. 125 uses, half of them, more than half, are in Paul, and most of the rest of them are in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. John does not use the word at all, interestingly. But I thought it would be good just to look at a few of these in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Let me read some of them to you, since everybody doesn't have Bibles with them. Matthew 11. John the Baptist. I think of the background for a moment here, will you? This fellow who had Super Bowl Sunday as a part of his program and telling us what Jesus would do, that boy, he'd be right there in Miami, he'd be organizing Super Bowl Sundays and so on. Well, John wants to know from jail, are you the Messiah? Are you the one who is to come? And then Jesus answered, go and tell John what you hear and see. The blind receive their sight, the lame walk, lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised, and the poor have good news brought to them. Good news, gospel. And then he concludes, blessed is anyone who takes no offense at me. I think the point to be made here is that all of the things that Jesus is talking about when he is answering John's question have to do with one simple thing. Jesus is himself the Messiah, the Christ of Israel. And the way he is Messiah is to evoke all of the things that are to happen when Messiah comes, and above all, that the poor, we're going to come back to that, have the gospel preached to them. Mark 1, 14 to 15, another place, crucial. Mark begins by saying, now after John was arrested, Jesus came to Galilee proclaiming the gospel of God and saying, the time is fulfilled, the kingdom of God has come near, repent. That is, get a whole new outlook and believe this good news. What is the good news? That the kingdom of God has come, that the reign of God is happening. Luke 4, another example. Jesus is in the synagogue in Nazareth, and he is given the scroll of the prophet Isaiah. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to bring the gospel to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim release to the captives, recovery of sight to the blind, to let the oppressed go free, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. Most scholars today understand this to be the Jubilee year, the 50th year. Seven times seven, there was a sabbatical every seventh year, and the 50th year is the Jubilee year. What's to happen in the Jubilee year? All debts get canceled. All land that has been lost or strayed or stolen or traded or whatever gets returned to its original owners. I mean, this is economic upset of the first order. And we don't know whether there ever was an observance of the Jubilee year, but we do know from some scholars that bankers got very nervous about the 47th year or so and stopped lending money, because just in case it might happen, you see. Now, what do all of these things have in common? One more place I want to look. Romans 1, the beginning.